One breath away from Mother Oceania. Your nimble feet make prints in my sand.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast, which comes this week from the Faroe Islands. You've heard of them, but you've no idea where they are. Well, you're not alone.
Had never heard of these islands, I'm ashamed to say.
There are 18 of them tucked away in the North Atlantic. They're self-governing with their own language, though they've been part of the Kingdom of Denmark since 1814. They're home to 50,000 people and 70,000 sheep. And they're probably best known to most of us from the shipping forecast.
Rain or showers, moderate or good. Faroe, Faroes, southeast Iceland, easterly or northeasterly, 4 or 5, increasing 6 at times, showers, fog patches, moderate or good, occasionally very poor.
But the gales that have been sweeping from the Faroese capital Tórshavn have been of laughter, debate and occasional squalls of disagreement, as writers and academics from 12 islands around the world, including several that are named in the shipping forecast, gathered to investigate the island in literature. The three-day conference, perhaps in view of its glorious conviviality, we should call it a moot, was the brainchild of the Icelandic novelist and lyricist Sjón. Those were his lyrics at the top of the programme to Björk's track Oceania. So I asked him in the rather clattery corner of a local hotel how it had come about and what its purpose was.
It had been an old dream of mine to bring together authors from islands and to see what happened when we shared our stories and our experiences of being authors, sometimes in tiny communities, sometimes in landlocked, bigger countries like Japan and Indonesia, and like I said, the smaller communities like in Åland, this tiny island in the Baltic. And I came here for a literature festival in November 2014. And as I was just walking around here and meeting the people, authors, and Sif Gunnarsdóttir, the director of the Nordic House, it all of a sudden struck me that this old idea had found its place. And the reason is that the Faroe Islands and Tórshavn produced one of the giants of 20th century Nordic literature, William Heinesen. And for me, he is a symbol of that miracle, when the tiniest of places brings forward a world artist. So I thought by hosting the festival conference here, you know, we would be inside the metaphor and the miracle, you know, discussion and the sharing of experiences should come easy.
And when we're talking small, we're talking a country that celebrated reaching 50,000 citizens quite recently.
Yes, the Faroe Islands are smaller than Iceland, which is always a comfort to us Icelanders, that there is actually a smaller place somewhere. So, yes, and at the turn of the 20th century, when Heinesen was born, you know, there were, I don't know how many thousand people living here in Tórshavn. And he somehow manages to make this microcosmos a platform for incredibly complex, universal stories. And he's had quite an influence on Icelandic literature. We have our own giant, Halldór Laxness, the Nobel Prize winner from 1955. And we're also a small place. And a small place with a single giant, you know, it can lead to, let's say, quite a monotonous discussion about what literature can do. So we always had Heinesen. We always had Heinesen as the other example of a great author coming from somewhere. And so he's inspired quite many of us.
We'll come back to Heinesen a bit later, but I want to now talk a little bit about your work and what the influence of being from an island has been on your work. Now, your most recent novel is Moonstone, The Boy Who Never Was, which is set in 1918 during the flu pandemic. And it's also set during a historical eruption. And we all know the two things everybody knows about Iceland. One is that they did incredibly unusually well in the World Cup. And the other is that they put the whole of the world's aviation industry out of business with an eruption.
Absolutely. And 1918, the autumn of 1918, over the span of 6 weeks, so many things happened in the life of this tiny nation, tiny place. There was the volcanic eruption of Katla, which began around the middle of October. the Spanish influenza arrived at the beginning of November. And on the 1st of December, we became a sovereign country. So historically, those weeks are amazing. And I had for a long while been looking for a story that I could somehow place during those weeks of volcanic eruption, pandemic, and celebration of independence. And when I started looking at this, I mean, I realized that so many of the elements of the story had to do with the fact that we are an island, that we are an isolated place. Those are also the last days of the Great War. So Iceland had until that point been north of war, as we say in Iceland. You know, we live north of war. We weren't touched by the Great War at all. You know, there was some coal shortage and a bit uncomfortable, you know. But then at the last hour, we are hooked into the narrative of the Great War when the influenza arrives. And the influenza shows that even a place like that is vulnerable and open to events in the big world.
That is one of the themes that's been bubbling under in this conference, isn't it? Is how actually isolated islands are.
Yes, I think we are always aware of the fact that we would not survive like total isolation. I mean, in Iceland, I mean, we rely on import for food, you know, and we rely so much on contact with the bigger world. And the volcanic eruption in Eyjafjallajökull, which everybody knows about, was a reminder of our island existence, you know, because it closed off the airports. I think when you're living on an island as small as Iceland, you know, you are constantly aware of the fact that you are on an island and things can go horribly wrong. But we have also always been, I think, a community that on one hand goes out into the big world to fetch things and bring back home, you know, new things from the great cultural centers. And we use them to inspire us. All the high points of Icelandic literature are when Icelandic literature has embraced outside influence, the Baroque, the Romantic movement, Surrealism, and so forth.
As Sean mentioned, the poet laureate of the Faroes and the author in whose honour the conference took its title, The Tower at the End of the World, is William Heinesen, who lived from 1900 to 1991 in Tórshavn, ending his days in a little clapboard house on a hill, which is now a national museum. He was an artist and a musician as well as a writer. His novels are in the process of being translated into English by the UK indie publisher Daedalus. It's published 5 already, with another 2 scheduled for next year. Taking time out from a late-night drinks party at the National Theatre, where the conference took place, the Faroese academic Birger Rona Mørberg takes up Heinesen's story and introduces a new scholarly theory, the literature of the ultraminor.
William Heinesen is a Danish Faroese author, and he wrote in Danish, but all his settings are in on a Faroese background. So he was born in the year of 1900, and he died as 91 year old in 1991. And he has written a kind about Faroese literature. He has written about Faroese history. He is in a way the iconic figure of Faroese literature. And he has written 7 novels, 7 collections of short stories, and 7 collections of poems.
And he was a musician and an artist as well, and he's got an exhibition at the National Gallery here.
Exactly, yeah.
And one of the themes that seems to have come out of this is that if you live in a small place, you have to be able to do everything.
Yeah, exactly. He was what we call in Danish a tusindkunstner, a thousand artist. It means he was a composer and a painter and a writer, as you say. And he was very engaged within the Faroese cultural life, in Tórshavn in particular, within the theatre and illustrating books with his paper cutting and so on. But while at the same time, he lived in a kind of internal exile, because he wrote in Danish, and that was not very popular. But it was his choice to write in Danish, you can say, because that was his possibility to get a bigger audience.
And it was his novel, The Tower of the End of the World, that gave this conference its title.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it was written in 1976, and it's a self-biographical novel, more or less, but Heinzen is never only self-biography. It's always the poetry and creation and universal perspectives. So he's a very universal writer. Because he is a very local writer, so these dimensions are very closely connected, inspired by all kinds of ideas, from Taoism to Christianity and the Nordic mythology.
His novel, The Lost Musicians, opens with these 10 lines that everybody keeps telling me I have to read, and we have a reading here.
Far out in a radiant ocean, glinting like quicksilver, there lies a solitary little lead-coloured land. The tiny rocky shore is to the vast ocean just about the same as a grain of sand to the floor of a dance hall. But seen beneath a magnifying glass, this grain of sand is nevertheless a whole world with mountains and valleys, sounds and fjords, and houses with small people. Indeed, in one place, there's even a complete little old town with quays and storehouses, streets and lanes and steep alleyways, gardens and squares and churchyards. There's also a little church situated high up, from whose tower there's a view over the roofs of the town and further out across the almighty ocean.
So, can you explain to me what is the significance of those first opening lines of that novel?
Yeah, it is. It's a kind of a literary mapping. He is mapping the Faroe Islands, because the Faroe Islands is, for the most part, traditionally in the most of the context, it is invisible because it is so small. And so Heinzen in Die Vertappte Spillemann, The Lost Musicians, he is highlighting this tiny little place within the middle of the North Atlantic. So he has a strategy in a way. There's a narrator high in the sky, seeing this island through a magnifying glass, and then he dives down into these islands, and he lands in a small town, or more to be more specific, in a church tower, and then afterwards, then he turns around and then look out into the almighty ocean, as he puts it. It is a very interesting movement, because in the first place he is looking at the Faroe Islands from the outside, and then he dives down into the Faroe Islands and then look out again in the direction of where he come from.
In the National Gallery, where all his artwork is, there's a big statue outside, and it's of a pregnant woman.
Yeah.
And her reflection, so she is replicated. And yeah. This is a recurrent theme, is somebody replicated in the water. And that seems to me to tie up with your radical theory, which you've introduced to this conference, which is about ultra-minor literature.
Yes.
And it's partly to do with the reflection and the bigger thing being underneath. And can you just explain this to us?
Yeah, I'm together with David Demarest, a professor at Harvard University. So we have launched this idea or concept about ultra-minor literature and culture, you might say. Ultra-minor literature, first and foremost. And I'm working with in three steps. First of all, I'm focusing on what is very tiny and small. Faroe Islands and many other islands, they are very small. We call them ultra-minor. The land-based geography itself is small. But the most important and the firm criteria for talking about ultra-minor, that is the population. So there are many, many different parameters of what is small, but the population is the most important one. So that's the first step. And the second step is, and now we are getting close to what literature and art, that is within literature, that the size is influencing the aesthetics and the way you tell stories in the Faroe Islands and in ultra-minor literatures in general. How is that? Because you can register that in the Faroese narratives, there is this tendency to compensate for smallness or for the ultra-minor. There's also always a kind of compensating strategy, because this compensation is a way of reflecting upon the lack of capacity and the smallness within the Faroese culture. And then the third step, it is to create an imagination and enlarging the small islands. So the literature and the ultra-minor dimension within literature, it's a kind of, it's a, you are compensating for the ultra minor by enlarging the islands through fantasy and so on.
And part of that fantasy is what lies underneath the water surface that you can't see, which we've seen in the statue and you see in that, that exactly. opening paragraph in that novel.
Yeah, exactly. Faroe Islands is a, it's so small, but it has its own underworld in a way. The small, tiny phenomena as the grain of sand in the beginning of The Lost Musicians, it has its own whole world in a way. When you use your fantasy and imagination, you can see a whole world in a grain of sand.
Birgerona Moberg there. So how does it feel to be ultra minor? The Shetland novelist and poet Robert Allen Jameson brought a robust Scottish humour to the linguistic challenges it poses.
These are poems from a sequence of responses to the language question. That is to say, how do you deal with the fact that globalization or a dominant language is eroding your local tongue? They're quite playful. This is number 2 in a sequence of 30. In English, it's a diminution making small in the local pity-wise. Welcome to the Folk Museum. It's a piri muti croft growing piri muti its, but piri muti yows and piri muti horses. Sees do the piri Shetland kai, the piri puri lion clurin, and the piri muti hoos for the piri muti frock, speaking piri muti words about piri muti matters. Secus, will we hae an York to keep the bairns, or Dan? Tinks do sell we mac for Canada.
It sounds almost Scandinavian.
Well, it is in part. It's a sort of Creole. It includes, obviously, some English and a lot of Scots. But Dutch is a factor as well, because for 300 years, the Hanseatic traders, north of Germany, Frisia and the like, were the primary trading partners with Shetland. And, of course, there's a sort of residual element of the old Norse tongue that died out around about the end of the 18th century. Do you want to hear it in English? Welcome to the Folk Museum. It's a tiny little small holding, growing tiny little crops for tiny little sheep and tiny little ponies. Look, see the little Shetland cattle, the little cat lying scratching, and the tiny little house for the tiny little people talking tiny little words about tiny little matters like, will we have enough to feed the children? Or do you think we should start afresh in Canada?
There's a saying, a language is a dialect with an army, but as one speaker pointed out, this doesn't necessarily apply to islands. In places like Greenland or Shetland, a language is a dialect with an ocean. In a rather noisy bar where we'd taken shelter from the interminable Faroese drizzle, I asked Jameson and the young Greenlandic novelist Niviaq Korneliusson about their island's struggle with language.
You've made a decision to write in Greenlandic. And one of the fascinating things about it is the way that you make compound words, words that get longer and longer and longer.
Well, like generally, the Greenlandic words are very, very long. But I mix a lot of with the Danish language and English. But of course, I chose to write in Greenlandic because that's my mother tongue. But I wrote it in, I translated into Danish myself as well. Maybe I could have translated it into English, but it's not like it's too far away. So that's very important to me because the Greenlandic literature scene is very new. And when Greenlandic authors write novels or short stories, it's mainly about the hunting years, the hunting period, like long, long, long time ago. Or maybe it's about the 70s. So it's very, like, old. So it was very important to me to write in Greenlandic, so to speak to young Greenlanders in a language they can understand.
Now, I'm going to move over to you, Robert Allen Jameson, from the Shetlands, but no longer living in the Shetlands.
I correct Shetlands, first of all, Shetland.
Oh, so sorry. I always go, that's a very English thing, isn't it?
Well,
talk about the
English,
Shetlands.
And it's something that you'd hear within Scotland as well. But no, it's simply Shetland. It's an archipelago of over 100 islands, inhabited perhaps 13 of those. It lies midway, really, between Faroe and Denmark, so that the ferry passes by but doesn't stop. Shetland was historically part of the Norse Empire, if you like, that was administered from Bergen in Norway during the Viking Age. And so the culture of Faroe and Shetland during that time was actually very similar.
So genetically, you might be Norse as much as Scottish, would you?
Well, I know for a fact that my father's family lived in the same village back until the 16th century, and that we were the last family in the parish to change from the patronymic naming system around about 1800. And I know that my mother's family also has that sort of length of root. But my other two grandparents are Scots, and Shetland was colonized by the Scots after, well, 1469. What happened was that the King of Scotland was about to marry the Danish princess, and the Danish crown at that time was a little hard up. They couldn't raise the dowry, so the Danish king decided that he would mortgage both Orkney and Shetland and then redeem the pledge at a later time. They attempted to do exactly that. The Scots wouldn't sell, wouldn't give them back. So we became, after having had 500 years of Norse cultural identity, we became over the period of the next 200-300 years Scottish. So the language, the old Norse language, which had been in use for 500 years or so, slowly was eroded because Scots, subsequently English, was the language of power, the language of dominance, courts and church and school, etc.
But what you've done is you have recreated a language which you feel is true to those origins, haven't you, in your novels?
Not in my novels so much, although I have included some, but in poetry particularly. The rebirth, if you like, of what has by then become a kind of creole of Norse origin and Scots and English begins in the late 19th century. And it's quite a, you know, cultural reawakening, if you like, in Shetland of that Norse identity. And that goes on apace, really, up until my era. My personal view is that I came from a very isolated part of the islands, the end of the road west. We've used in this conference this week this idea of the edge of the world, the end of the world, and you know everyone in all these island groups seems to have some equivalent of it. Well, that's where I came from in the Shetland context. So it was a very particular form of the language, and quite antiquated and strange even to people in other parts of Shetland. So for me, the attempts to write it down, which had happened in the sort of 100 years or so prior to my beginnings as a writer, seemed too anglicized, seemed too non-specific. And so I went back to the voices of the old people in my head. My great-grandmother, who lived with us in the house, was quite a big influence in that. I started to work phonetically, really, and I looked at the English alphabet and found it inadequate for the sounds that I heard. There was a lovely quote earlier today in one of the papers, wasn't there, from the Icelander, who said, "This is the alphabet, here it is, make use of it until you find a better one." So I had to find a better one.
But he actually, I was counting the characters in that Icelandic alphabet, and there were something like 40 or 50 characters of the double letters, the letters and things, and you've done that.
Well, yeah, because these are particular sounds. And, you know, for me, it's about authenticity. It's about trying to replicate in a written way, and written language will never quite correspond to spoken. It's a failed task before you even begin. But, you know, you want to get, at least I do as a writer, back to something that seems to me to be echt, you know, authentic. Yeah.
Niviak, your project is much more modern, isn't it? I mean, your characters are gay. I mean, not all of them, obviously, but you also have references to popular culture, to music and things like that.
Yes. As I said, I was trying to use a language that the younger people could understand. It's only been like 100 years since the first novel in Greenlandic was published, so it's very new. But the old books that was written in Greenlandic, they're like very classic, they're very long, and all they talk about is like the nature and how the nature influences you and everything else. So I wanted to get away from that and just tell a reality that hasn't really been heard in Scandinavia or the rest of the world.
In the Caribbean, where islands have long been regarded as convenient trading posts ripe for colonial exploitation, language and power are historically entangled. The anything but ultra-minor Derek Walcott was much cited by speakers at the conference, so here he is, reading his poem Sea Grapes in 2005 after receiving his Nobel Prize in Literature.
Sea Grapes. That sail which leans on light, tired of islands. A schooner beating up the Caribbean for home could be Odysseus, homebound on the Aegean. That father and husband's longing under gnarled sour grapes is like the adulterer hearing Nausicaa's name in every gull's outcry. This brings nobody peace. The ancient war between obsession and responsibility will never finish and has been the same for the sea wanderer or the one on shore now wriggling on his sandals to walk home since Troy sighed its last flame and the blind giant's boulder heaved the trough from whose ground swell the great hexameters come to the conclusions of exhausted surf. The classics can console, but not enough.
And here's Paulette Ramsey, a Jamaican poet and professor at the University of the West Indies, on the cultural and linguistic complexities of the Caribbean.
The Caribbean, of course, is a multilingual area. Some islands speak Dutch, some speak French, some speak Spanish, and some speak English. Jamaica, of course, is one of the four largest islands, and we are the only English-speaking ones in that area. So, ironically, we are surrounded by Spanish-speaking islands. Cuba is our closest neighbor. But we cannot say that Spanish is really spoken very widely in the country. So it's compulsory in secondary schools. Some students choose to continue and do their degrees in Spanish. But it is quite a challenge trying to convince people to learn Spanish. So there's a big debate going on about that. In addition to our sort of internal political angst, if you want to call it that, about Creole and English. There are some who believe that, you know, we should encourage the speaking of nation language more so than English. And then there's a smaller, unpopular minority who feels that, yes, it's good to speak Creole. We all speak Creole. It's it's the mother tongue of most persons, not all Jamaicans. But it is not sufficiently international to take us anywhere communicating with people outside of Jamaica. So there's a big polemic, big controversy as far as language is concerned.
Two writers from opposite ends of the world who found a lot in common at the conference were Tasmanian Pete Hay and the Newfoundland novelist Donna Morrissey. So we took advantage of a break in the clouds for a jaunt down to Tórshavn's pretty little harbour.
Just explain to me what you can see here and how it relates to your experience of living in coastal places.
Well, the very first thing is the salty taste on my lips. And, of course, the damp of the rain on my face. And as I look out over this harbour, if it wasn't for all of those yachts down there, I would think I was in St. John's, Newfoundland. The coloured houses and the hills up there and the mist and the buildings and the rusted old ships over there.
Pete.
This is nothing like the harbour that I'm used to. My harbour would be a harbour with fishing boats, mainly what we would call cray boats, but here you would call them lobster boats. So again, the plethora of pleasure craft, it sort of spoils it a bit for me. Although down there, I've had a good look at this, I wandered around this morning, there are these wonderful old, I don't know how old they are, but wonderful working boats with sort of dragon prows that I think pretty much is the good signature of the harbour that's out here in front of us.
And you're here as one of the academics and also as a poet, and your poetry has actually been published in the UK, but it's very, very specific to Tasmania, isn't it?
Yes, it's very specific to Tasmania. I walk around Sydney and I get depressed because I can't think of one good reason why anyone who lives in Sydney, Australia, would want to read a single word that I write, let alone on this side of the planet. I'm so grateful to my publisher for publishing me. I can only think it's an act of inspired folly on his part.
He's just so humble.
He's ridiculously humble.
Yes, but we know differently.
Donna, your The Good Brother is just out in the UK, and although it's self-standing, it is actually the third part of a trilogy, which begins with the disintegration of a fishing community. Tell us a bit about this fishing community, because it's like the one you grew up in.
Yes, well, in Newfoundland, again, I grew up in an outport of 12 houses, and everybody fished or worked in the forest, you know, all seasonal. And the novel was, the first one, Sylvanus Now, was inspired by the loss of the fishery that broke the backbone of so many little, because Newfoundland is coastal, 10,000 kilometers of coast, and so what the fishery went, it all went, and so we paid dearly for that. And so the Sylvanus Now was a novel inspired by that, but also by my mother, you know, the my tower and her story, and then the loss of the outmigration and my brother and I going off into Canada and the oil fields to make the black gold, you know, the money. And of course, the tragedy happened in our family there, and it happened in a lot of families where the young men got killed in crazy accidents, and then it's the going home, you know, with despair and the feelings of failure and loss and grief. And then the story still wasn't told, so then I wrote the third novel, and again, they all stand alone. But the third one is the story of grief and of the young boy trying to, you know, be the surrogate husband to the mother who was cleansing her house of grief, and trying to be a crutch for the father who was losing himself in alcohol. And my God, there's a happy ending from all of that.
But the bit that you talked so passionately about at the, mm-hmm. at the conference was about your uncle.
Yes.
And tell us about your uncle.
Well, I profiled him in my novel because he was a face for everything that went wrong in terms of identity. Because when you're born and raised in the community and you are created yourself from the land around you and the ocean, and then suddenly you're 57 years of age and your health is, you know, you're shaped. You're shaped around the ocean, you're shaped around your boat, and you fit magically in your environment. But then with the destruction of the fishery, we had so many of these men, not just old men, but younger too, who sons were already living in Toronto and bigger places. And so now they're saying, come on, Dad, you know, we're going to take you with us into the city, and we're going to get you a job in the factory. And the ultimate feelings of despair and sadness and fear on their faces from having to leave this place where they fitted, and to now go into this other environment where they will be an oddity. You know, you look like the elephant man there because you don't fit here. But yet this is where you're being forced. Or a lot felt they were forced, but a lot did not bend to that. They stayed where they were and they act out livings, and they just did it a different way. They found other fish and other means of making their living. God bless them.
So one of the underlying stories has been about the despoliation of the environment. And in your collection, Pete, you have a poem called Flotsam, about Flotsam.
Yes. My island is a wild island, and two-thirds of it sits under virgin forest. But it's such a conflicted island. We fight over the meanings of the island. In the paper that I gave, I set up a scenario of two rival dreamings, an old-fashioned industrial dreaming, a dreaming that has run its course, whereby we turned our back on the past. We were only interested in the future, and the future was going to be one of the creation of Arura Valley in the Southern Seas. It was complete folly. It was never going to happen. And then the train wreck of globalisation arrived, and we've had to find new ways of working out what it means to be Tasmanian. The old dreaming still survives, but against that, there are people very determinedly attempting to say the past matters, that memory matters, that you can't just completely break with a very, very awful history. We're a society that in three short decades completely destroyed a stable and functional Aboriginal society. In the 20th century, we set about deliberately destroying, eradicating the world's largest marsupial carnivore. You know, we have a lot to look in the face. The poem about Flotsam to me is a sort of a metaphor for this. No matter how much we try to turn our back on history, And we look at our feet and there it is washed up around our ankles.
So you two have been one of the, you've been a double act really, haven't you, at the festival? And I wondered what it is. You sort of seem to be ridden with guilt, but you're angry, Donna.
I am.
Are you the yin and yang of
Don't
island
tell me
life?
The X's are right.
I'm angry as well, don't worry.
I'm angry at the negligence, and because everybody saw the germ of his own demise in the industry that was sweeping away our fish. Everybody saw that, but again, it was so discounted, and the fishermen were discounted and looked at as folklore against, you know, the massive scientific data of the corporate world and the federal governments. And so that is angering. I think the thing of beauty that is happening right now is when there was this huge out-migration. Now, we've lived through out-migrations before. As Pete said, you know, we keep coming back and we will keep coming back because our children are now growing up and they are coming of age. 25 years is a long time. So we've got these kids who are born and raised in Toronto, and they know when they come home to visit Nan and Gran in the outports, they're seeing culture. They don't see that in Toronto, but they see it when they come home. They've got the taste of the salt on their lips, and they've got their skidoos. They've got their boats. And they've got freedom like they've never had, and the language. And they love it. And they don't want to go to Florida come January and February. They want to go back with Nana Grant on the rock, you know. And so we will come back. We are coming back.
And with perfect timing, a little fishing boat has just arrived, chugged into the harbour. It's coming back.
Isn't that lovely?
And that's all for this week. William Heinesen's novels are published by Daedalus, Donna Morrissey's The Fortunate Brother is just out in the UK from Canongate, and Sean's novel Moonstone, The Boy Who Never Was is published by Scepter in the UK and Farrar, Straus and Giroux in the US. Next week we'll be reporting from the Hay Festival in Wales, where amongst other delights we'll be interviewing the Indian politician Shashi Tharoor about his revisionist history of British colonialism in India. To find us or any of the other marvellous podcasts we make here at The Guardian, go to theguardian.com/podcasts. Just spark up your favourite podcast app and search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can join the conversation too, either by commenting on The Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Tresillian, goodbye and thanks for travelling with us.